maybe I'll begin now. So hello everyone, thanks for coming. My name is Eric Davis. In addition to my day job as a teacher of religious studies at McAllister College in St. Paul, I am a full-time unionist and activist of various sorts. I'm going to give a brief history of the IWW, a very brief history of the early days, and why it was founded and how it was founded and the basic principles on which it was founded and still works today. But I wanted to, before I started, set up some basic sort of context. The IWW is sometimes called the Chicago Idea, and that's because its founding Congress was in 1905 in Chicago. Many of you are aware of something called the Haymarket Massacre, yes? So the Haymarket Massacre was when a bunch of recent European immigrants, mostly Germans, a lot of Slavs as well, and some Irish, in Chicago at the time was very, very, as it is today, highly ethnically segregated. And all these different people from countries all over the world came and settled in Chicago where the giant threshing mills at the edge of the prairie were. So this was the place where the prairie agricultural industries met the threshing industries, which would then process the grain and send it all over the world. It was an enormous and thriving new market. It was the beginnings of mechanization in a lot of ways in Chicago. And along with mechanization, all the typical wage struggles that you see. The Haymarket Massacre was the response to the long-running struggle by these same immigrants for the eight-hour day. How many people here work an eight-hour day? Most of us have lost that right at this point, right? If we call it an eight-hour day, usually we're paying for our own lunch, right? Insofar as we have limited and legal work limits on our working hours, that is because of these immigrants at that point in time. Celebrating on May Day, May 1st, which is International Labor Day, as opposed to the Labor Day that's coming up soon, which is the only country in the world that celebrates Labor Day at a different day than May 1st. There's a reason for that, which I'll tell you very briefly, which is that once May Day became so international, in an attempt to discipline the internationalism of the United States labor, organized labor, they decided, we're not going to celebrate May 1st as Labor Day, we're going to give you Labor Day in the fall, and instead we're going to rename, and to this day, presidents every May 1st sign into law, sign an order declaring May 1st Law Day and Loyalty Day. So that's what we've done with internationalism here. But a lot of the Chicago idea in 1905 came out of and drew upon those same currents that gave us the eight-hour day, that led to lots of struggle, that led to eight people being executed in Chicago in the late 1880s for their political beliefs, not for anything that they were supposed to have done. 1886 was the execution. They were the August Spees, Albert Parsons, eight people who were sometimes accused at various points of having orchestrated a bombing, which at this point most historians think was actually a police bombing. It would have been silly for the activists to have bombed their own crowd, right? But all sorts of crazy things were made. At the end of the trial, it was very clear to everyone, including the prosecutor, that nobody was being accused of actually doing anything. They were accused of holding beliefs. Beliefs in the inherent equality of all humanity, regardless of sex, creed, religion, language, nationality, or anything else. And beliefs that humanity could rule itself cooperatively rather than through being ordered around or being forced into various forms of action on pain of violence and starvation. Anybody have any idea what this little weird shoe is doing up here?
Oh. Does it have to do with sabotage?
It does. It does. And the particular meaning of the word sabotage, which is different from what most of us think. Most of us think sabotage, and we think Alfred Hitchcock's 1931 film where there's spies going from place to place, you know, blowing up trains and stuff. Sabotage comes from this word. It comes from the word for the wooden shoe, the sabot. Why would we call some... What the heck would that mean? Well, urban waged workers, the labor movement proper, comes out of urban waged workers. And when urban waged workers in France began to organize, their employers hired people from the countryside to to come in and act as strike breakers, to knock heads and replace their jobs. The thing is that rural workers were not nearly as well off as urban waged workers, had poorer types of clothing. Specifically, they didn't have the leather shoes that urban workers were wearing. They had these big sabots. You can't work very well in sabots. You walk slow. You walk clumsy. So the original meaning of sabotage was to slow your work down, to act a fool, to basically sabotage the profits of your employer in order to make them buckle to your will. Today we have words like work to rule strikes. Has anyone heard that one? Yes, okay, so what's a work to rule strike, sir?
The workers follow the rules exactly.
Yes.
You know, most of the time you're a little bit lax about it, you know what you're supposed to do and you know how to do it and stuff, but you follow the rules to the letter to kind of slow things down and get your point across.
That's exactly. Most of the time the working conditions under which we labor are actually, it's required for us to break the rules, right? In order for the work to go efficiently. All sorts of rules exist out there, but in order for us to get the job done, we need to break all sorts of rules. But when the boss is coming at us and we decide on a work-to-rule strike, we follow those rules to the letter. So it's holding the laws and the rules that the boss issues against themselves, okay? So that's where the IWW comes from, and I wanted to emphasize the sabot at the beginning to dispel some images of sabotage, which are very frequent. All right, these are the beginning words of the famous preamble of the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World. The working class and the employing class have nothing at all in common. Now notice it does not say that workers and employers have nothing in common. It says the working class and the employing class have nothing in common. To say that workers and employers have nothing in common would be ridiculous. We are human beings, we eat, we love, we live, we have families. I've met a number of very nice employers, I've even had a couple of nice bosses. That's not what this says. What this says is that in the workplace, the working class and the employing class are invariably and inevitably at odds. The employers make money deliberately and intentionally, it's the only way they can do so, by making sure that the labor costs are below, as low as they can be. After all, what does minimum wage mean? Minimum wage means I couldn't pay you less. I'd like to, but I can't, right? And so that's why wages have always been one of the dominant areas of contest. It's because that's where employer profits come from. Now, there's all sorts of businesses which claim, oh, we're going bankrupt. Well, that may be, but your administrators and your officials are also pulling down millions and hundreds of millions of dollars in personal salary, right? And if you put that back into the pot, suddenly things look quite a bit different, right? Okay. So the working class and the employing class have nothing in common. There can be no peace so long as hunger and want are found among the millions of working people and the few who are called the employing class have all the good things in life. There's a wonderful annotated version of the IWW preamble, which was just released about 3 years ago, which I highly recommend to anyone. Just look it up on Google, annotated IWW preamble. You'll find it instantly. It's a lovely introduction to probably the most important document in IWW history, and given the role of the IWW, which today is a very small union, in comparison to its historic size and strength. But given the historical influence of the IWW, it's important to understanding unions as a whole. This is our globe, our badge, and our slogan. An injury to one is an injury to all. There can be no one left out. All people must be equal. We must all be fed, we must all eat, we must all be housed. We must all see doctors from time to time. We must all be educated. We all have similar needs. As human beings, we deserve equal dignity. And when one person is hurt, ignoring that becomes an invitation to further oppression. Many of you will know Martin Niemöller, Pastor Martin Niemöller's famous saying about the Nazis. First they came for the communists, and I did not speak up, for I was not a communist. Right? And eventually, after going through all the different people, the communists are easy to forget about, right? I mean, becoming an anti-capitalist in America is very much like joining a cult, right? Nobody wants to have anything to do with you. You sound like a crazy person, right? And your family will be embarrassed if you talk in public at dinners, right? So At the same time, we refuse that embarrassment. Oppression to one person is an oppression to all of us. And it is on the basis of that solidarity. That solidarity. Solidarity. Being solid together. One group. Right? That we can win. That's our fault. The STARS stand for agitation, education, and emancipation. And that is our program. These days, we have an organizer training which relies on the vowels as an acronym. A-E-I-O-U, agitation, education, inoculation, organization, and unionization. So we've added two there. Inoculation means once you start thinking about how to organize, what do you think the boss is going to do in response? Because you don't want to start a plan and then get surprised by how bad the response is, right? A lot of campaigns have been naively destroyed by refusing to think strategically ahead of time. So inoculation is important. This is a very old, old image of the pyramid of capitalism. This is kind of the IWW idea from a long time ago. Capitalists, the capitalism pyramid, we rule you, and you've got kings and politicians and bankers up here. We fool you. This is institutional clerical religion. Now, there were many, many deeply devout people who were part of the IWW, but the IWW, especially in its early days, had a very anti-clerical bent. This is specifically because most of the time institutional churches were taking very, very public stands against worker organization. In my own neighborhood in St. Paul, anybody from Minnesota seen the beautiful St. Paul Cathedral? Funded, 20% of that was funded by J.J. Hill, who wrote in his letter of donation, "I certainly hope that the influence of the church can rein in working class radicalism." All right. So the church was definitely opposed in many ways to the working class. The Salvation Army is responsible for the vast majority of the IWW's songs in the Little Red Songbook, including the song Solidarity Forever, which is the anthem of the United States labor movement. The reason the Salvation Army was responsible for that is that they used to be used as interrupters of public meetings. So the Salvation Army would send their bands with their drums and their tubas and their trumpets to anywhere the IWW was having a public meeting and try and drown us out. In response, we wouldn't try and fight them off or yell at them. We would just change the words to all their songs. So instead of, in the sweet by and by, we have pie in the sky. Right? You'll have pie in the sky when you die. That's a lie. Right? All right. So that's where some of this anti-clericalism comes in. The IWW has always had explicit stances against any political endorsements or any public statements on religion itself. So we attempt to bring everyone into the fold, but we will not permit people to take authority over people and say, "You're going to hell if you join a union or if you don't join a union," right? These things have to be up to the workers themselves. We fool you. We shoot at you. Are the police and the military members of the working class? Absolutely. Absolutely. They are not part of the IWW because they serve at the pleasure of the people up here. And when given orders, their choices are to stop being police or to crush the workers' movement. And historically, that has been the contradiction that we have seen. And so that is the thing. We eat for you. Well, those are most of the employing class right there. Right? The people, they aren't working, but they sure are eating a lot. Right? And on the bottom is the 99%. We feed all and we work for all. Now, this is a rather crude diagram of society, but it was hella good propaganda. All right. Against this vision of the capitalist system, the IWW endorses the revolutionary call of the early Protestant Thomas Munzer, who predates Luther and was one of Luther's primary targets in 1525 after the Peasant Revolt. This is, along with Sola Gratia and the other three solas of the Protestant faith, Omnia sunt communia was one of the very early Latin phrases of Protestant revolution. It means everything belongs to everyone. That's the one Luther dropped. The IWW, founded in 1905 in Chicago, was inspired by the Knights of Labor, which was a craft organization, and I'll talk about craft versus industrial organization in a moment, but it's a craft organization, so organized plumbers into one part, and construction workers into another, and airline manufacturers in another, although there weren't any at the time. And the Knights of Labor were a radical solidarity-based organization which were not open to immigrants or non-English speakers or Catholics. So, great stuff, some good stuff there, just pretty racist. Okay. So, and a strong influence from the Western miners, especially in Colorado, the Western Federation of Miners. One of the early leaders of the IWW, Big Bill Haywood, lost his right eye as a 9-year-old miner in the Colorado mines. And the Colorado mines were notorious for being some of the most violently enforced working conditions in the United States at the time. So it was between the Western Federation of Miners and refugees, political refugees from the Knights of Labor, that much of the IWW was formed. And they were opposed to all divisions among the working class. So you can just go right down that. Craft, race, religion, political affiliation, language, sex, etc. And they were anti-political until there was a split in the IWW shortly after the Russian Revolution in 1917, where an American socialist and member of the IWW named Daniel DeLeon decided that the IWW needed to mount a party. After the success of the Soviet Revolution, or what was thought to be the success of the Soviet Revolution, everybody jumped on the communist bandwagon and said, ah, organizing political parties to take over the state is the way to go. And many of our leadership and early founders went that way. Big Bill Haywood even moved to Soviet Russia after a while. And like many American radicals and anarchists and others who went over there, he was deeply disappointed. Emma Goldman's famous, if I can't dance, I don't want to be part of your revolution, was a comment directed at Lenin and others after she attempted to become a Soviet citizen and then realized it wasn't for her. IWW principles, industrial organization versus craft organization. One of the biggest misconceptions about it, about the IWW, is that somehow industrial refers to heavy equipment. That's because that's what the word means for most of us these days. But if you think about it in terms of industry, industry by industry, instead of industrial machinery, you get a better sense of it. So the example that I like to use is that in 2005, there was a strike at Northwest Airlines where the mechanics went out. But the pilots and their union stayed in, and the flight attendants and their union stayed in. This is an example of craft organization, and it encourages unions to what we call scab on each other. If your employer is the enemy, and you're trying to make your employer buckle to your demands, it doesn't work as well if only 5% of you go out, no matter how much solidarity you have. They're easy to replace. If everyone at the workplace shuts down, on the other hand, it's much easier to get what you want. Things don't last as long, right? So I'm an education worker, I'm in the education union. So would custodians at my school. They would also be in the education workers union, right? Clerical workers at my school or in the education union if they would join. Okay? So that's the difference between industrial organization and craft organization. As I mentioned before, anti-political. Solidarity or minority unionism is a big part of the IWW. That means we are completely voluntarily based on voluntary membership. We have almost never had closed shops. We insist on voluntary membership and individuals paying their own dues. Right? You don't want to be a member of the IWW? Good for you. Enjoy. Right? We aren't going to force anyone to join, and we are perfectly happy being the minority group in a workplace. Being the minority group in a workplace does not lessen our efficiency and our efficacy, or hasn't historically anyway. Instead of contracts, we prefer direct action. We prefer not leaving the job. We would prefer not to strike. Instead, our idea, and the idea that has worked best for us and other workers wherever we've seen it in action, is to stay on the job and to control the job that we have. So the Republic Windows and Doors workers in Chicago a few years ago, when their factory was going to be illegally closed and moved to Iowa, the reason it was illegal was because they had received all sorts of tax benefits from the city in order to construct the original factory. But they claimed poverty and said, we're going to shut down the factory. And then it became clear that they were under a different name opening the same factory in Iowa where they could pay lower wages. The workers went into the factory and took it over. There was an occupation in 2008 during the election campaign of mostly Latino workers who took over the factory and ended up winning to the point where they are currently running the place as a co-op factory. Right? Now, co-ops have all sorts of other issues. Anybody been in a co-op? Yeah, sometimes they're a bit tricky. But co-ops have all sorts of other issues, but it's certainly a damn sight better than having all your wages go to some big cat who doesn't know how to make a window or a door. Direct democracy and rank and file control. That means that there are no officers that cannot be recalled like that. Officers serve no longer than one-year terms. There's one exception to this, which is the General Secretary Treasurer, who operates on typically a three-year term, but he's also recallable at any moment. And he is also the only paid officer in the entire union, the entire international. None of the rest of us draw any pay. And his pay, if I recall recently, is roughly $33,000 for what is estimated to be about 72 hours of work a week. The last thing is, remember, education, organization, and emancipation. We're good at agitation. We can agitate people. We know what's wrong with workplaces, and it's everybody else knows what's wrong with their workplaces. All you really have to do is say, so how's your job? And then listen. It's a good way of agitating anyone. The next stage is always education. Why is it like that at your workplace? And that's why so much of our current work as a small union is focused on education efforts. And that's where we'll end today at the end of this presentation. Some of the early heroes of the IWW will be known to many of you, some will not. Anybody recognize this dude? Oh, okay, he was going to be the most famous. That's Joe Hill. Joe Hill. Johannes, I can never pronounce his last name.
Hillestrom,
yes, from Sweden. And his home is now a historic site in Sweden. And he is probably the most famous musician of the IWW's very, very, it's a history full of musicians. But he's probably the most famous. He wrote many, many of our songs. He was executed in Utah for a trumped-up charge. He was supposed to have shot somebody. Somebody did get shot. But when he was shot, one of the big things is that his arms were clearly up because the bullet went through here but didn't go through his shirt. There's a whole bunch of other things, but it's a fun story. Unfortunately, it ended in his death. His last words were, "Don't mourn, organize." Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, the famed Rebel Girl, which is what everyone called her, went from town to town organizing young women. I should mention that although unionism in America has gotten a thuggish, masculine, hyper-macho reputation, thanks largely to the organization of business unions and, well, how many women run big corporations? Right? More men, right? Right? Unions are the same way. Once you get institutional sort of bureaucratic mechanisms of control and organization, the people who rise to the top are usually the scum, just like in a pot, right? So when the scum rise to the top, things get not so well organized at the bottom, right? That's one of the main reasons why we try and avoid any form of authoritarian organization in our group. But back in the original, in the early 20th century, women were really dominant in much of the labor movement. If you've heard of the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire, or in 1911, or the Leavitt strike, or the Lawrence, Massachusetts textile mill strikes, or the Patterson strike, these were all industries which were dominated by women, and in which most of the early history of garment factory unionization efforts were won by radical women between the ages of 12 and 22. Right. So Frank Little, my personal hero. Executed in Montana by members of the Anaconda Mine. I'm trying to remember, was it Dashiell Hammett? Dashiell Hammett used to be a Pinkerton, and I'll talk about them in just a moment. But he was also an author, and he wrote Red Morning, Red Dawn, something. It was about the situation at the Butte Mine where the Anaconda folks killed Frank Little for attempting to organize workers. He had escaped execution and lynching just a few years previously in Duluth, Minnesota. When he was trying to organize the Mesaba mine workers, they grabbed him, kidnapped him, pulled him out to a railway trestle, and lynched him there. They hung him and lit him. He managed to get the noose off his neck, walk the 6 miles back into town in time for his public presentation that evening. This is Big Bill Haywood, who you never ever see straight on or from the right side because he's missing his eye. I was very nervous about that. The immaculately dressed and coiffed Carlo Tresca. We have a Carlos Tresca fashion award these days, which is given out. And this is Elizabeth Gurley Flynn again. This is the wonderful Lucy Parsons. African American, Native American, She was the widow of Albert Parsons of the Haymarket Martyrs, and an early member of the IWW. And she lived all the way until the beginning of World War II, and never quieted down a moment. She was one of the most radical old women you'd ever want to meet. Mother Jones, Mary Harris Jones, she never joined the IWW, but was at the founding convention. Ben Fletcher worked as a longshoreman in Philadelphia, and was incredibly important in introducing the IWW and the Chicago idea to black workers on the East Coast. There's another picture of Big Bill Haywood. The reason I put that there is to remind myself to tell you the story about how he chose to address people at the Constitutional Convention. He was apparently stuck mostly on how to call the people assembled. Working men, crap, we're pro-female. Citizens, well, that excludes everybody who's not a citizen, right? And on and on and on. Finally, he came up with the simple thing he could find, and that was fellow workers. And to this day, we refer to ourselves and to each other as fellow workers. If you're trying to be polite inside the union, even if you're angry at somebody, you make sure you call them fellow worker. And that's usually an indication that you're pretty pissed. All right. Now, the IWW made massive success in the first two decades of the 20th century. However, we had a slogan, thanks to Frank Little, that we would engage in no war but the class war. And so we resisted the draft for World War I, along with people in the Midwest like the Nonpartisan League, who were also suffered similar persecution. If you look at this anarchist, anytime you see the word anarchist in a newspaper, it's always bomb-throwing crazy people, right? Anarchists demand a strike to end war. What horrible people. And the great gathering of IWW and other agitators rails against the selective draft. Those horrible Germans were in the audience. You can tell that's why they were bad. Anti-American, those Germans. And as a result, you get cartoons like this one, which attempt to show the IWW as friends of the Hun. Right? And it was shortly after that that the Pinkerton Detective Agency, along with the U.S. government, began a wholesale repression of the IWW that really knocked us on our butts until about 1990. Yeah, it's a very long time. We were around and had a lot of power through the mid-30s, but we were on a pretty constant decline. The Congress of Industrial Organization, the CIO that you often hear at the end of the AFL, right? They adopted the industrial organizing model of the IWW and made huge successes, especially in the early auto manufacturing areas of Detroit, until they were absorbed by the more conservative American Federation of Labor. The Taft-Hartley Act came along and insisted on no strike clauses in all contracts and no secondary strikes, which was a huge deal. The IWW became very quiet, with very small membership. We oftentimes refer to this period ruefully as the Joe Hill Historical Reenactment Society. Mm-hmm. Right? We had as few as 50 people at any given time in the 60s. We owe a lot to those people, although some of them are hard to get along with. As you can imagine, being an isolated anti-capitalist through 50 years might make you. Some of them are very hard to get along with. They are our elders. And as the great folk singer and IWW member Utah Phillips once said, that he was proud of being a member of the IWW because it was the only organization he'd ever joined which had never broken faith with their elders. He was also the only man to ever receive a lifetime membership card because he could never find a delegate because he was traveling all the time. The IWW really reawakened in the 1990s with a series of campaigns at Borders bookstores, which failed, most of them do. And especially in the 2000s, when we began to focus on the traditional demographic of IWW, historically unorganizable workers, especially food and retail, which has very high turnover. One of our most famous members is Professor Noam Chomsky. And this is the most simple explanation of what the IWW believes in and how we believe the world should operate itself. People should control their own work. If you're working, you probably know better than anybody else how your work ought to be done. And certainly together with your fellow workers, you can come up with the best way of getting the job done. And that's how we should do it. We should also reap all the rewards of our own labor. That shouldn't be passed off to somebody else who's not laboring. The Starbucks campaign. The Starbucks campaign began in 2004 and began in Manhattan. Manhattan has a lot of Starbucks stores. this is an example, is a cautionary tale about contract organizations and the National Labor Relations Board, or the NLRB. They went early on, very romantically, for a contract. They said, we've got all the baristas in this store, and we're going to have a vote. We know we'll win. The NLRB came back and said, well, Starbucks has asked that the voting include the entire island of Manhattan. So, of course, they lost. They weren't at the same stores, but they weren't even owned by the same franchise members, right? But every single barista and worker at a Starbucks was offered a chance to vote. And the way these votes go, that went down. It was gerrymandered to the entire island of Manhattan, not the entire city of New York, and it was lost. And we switched back to, again, the solidarity, union, and direct action model. The Starbucks campaign was also very important in returning our awareness to the centrality of a gender equity focus and an emphasis on worker safety and dignity. Many of our members, especially the female members in New York, had suffered very severe sexual harassment and even sexual violence on the job from their managers. And they were not getting the sort of attention they needed from their fellow workers in the union. They were not getting the sort of solidarity and sympathy they needed. And so they organized a women's and gender issues caucus. At this point, as you'll see towards the end, the IWW is tremendously progressive on gender issues. I think the IWW branch in the Twin Cities has roughly about 10% transgendered folks as members. And we begin every meeting by introducing ourselves and identifying which pronouns we would prefer to be identified with. This is Liberty Locke, who is one of the people who really headed up the gender equity campaign, which has spread throughout the entire union. She's a barista and organizer, and the author of My Body, My Rules, The Case for Rape and Domestic Violence Survivors Becoming Workplace Organizers, in which her argument is that the same techniques that abusive partners use on their victim partners, and the same techniques that rapists will often use, are the ones that you see many abusive bosses using in the workplace. Denigration, humiliation, sudden friendliness, and then out of the blue, you know. Let me talk a little bit about the Twin Cities IWW, which I've been a part of since it was chartered. We were chartered in 2005 after a series of years in which we held, in which a bunch of us held a festival called One Day in July, commemorating the 1934 Teamsters strike in the Twin Cities. That was an important event in Twin Cities labor history in which members of the Teamsters who had been, all the leadership had been IWWs before the IWW got destroyed. They ran what was called a flying squad. So instead of picketing around individual locations, they ran to wherever the trucks were running and stopped them. And this was incredibly successful, so much so that the governor at the time declared a state of emergency and had the National Guard brought in. I have the newspapers from 1934 declaring martial law on the street and saying that everyone owes immediate loyalty and obedience not only to the state of Minnesota and the United States government, but to a specific named general. And we used to have a summer festival in July commemorating this. It got enough attention that we got more and more members interested in chartering an IWW branch. And in 2005, we successfully chartered one. It was a very, very small group, about seven of us. And we were all white dudes, except for one guy was gay, but that was about as much diversity as we had at the time. We recognized this as a real challenge early on. We are now the second largest branch in the world, with active organizing in food and retail, education, communication, custodial, and temporary labor, and a number of other campaigns that I'm not at liberty to talk about since we're not public. This is the beginning of our May Day march in 2007. This is the branch's logo with the Mississippi River running between Minneapolis and St. Paul. These are pictures from the early Starbucks campaign when we went public during the Republican National Convention in 2008 in St. Paul, right outside the Mall of America. One of the things we were planning on doing, we had a cake and all sorts of signs welcoming the members who had previously been secret members and were going public to the union. One of the things that was interesting, we took the light rail down to the mall, and when we got there, we were greeted by a line of riot cops who refused to let anyone off the train, including people who had nothing to do with the union, people who were just going down, and sent us back downtown. It only came out later that this was an illegal interference with transportation on private property, but you know, the deed was done at that point. But we had a wonderful birthday party anyway for them and welcomed them in and had a cake and everything. It was lovely. This is my good friend on the right here, Sasha, who is now a member of the Junior Wobblies, which we began this last year. Starbucks in the Twin Cities began at the Mall of America, was in downtown locations as well. The issues were workplace safety and comfort. It's not often known how much the repetitive stress of the barista work can really cause injuries very fast, and people need to be shifted through those roles over the course of a day so that they don't simply wear themselves out very quickly. The other thing is that it gets very hot behind that counter, much hotter than you'd imagine by being on the other side of the counter. Especially at the Mall of America in the mornings, it was routinely got up to 112 degrees. Management refused to buy a fan, so in typical direct action style, after agitating for it a while, all the workers in the store got together and said, we're going to go get a fan. They opened the cash register, took out a $100 bill, went to Sears, purchased a fan, got the receipt, put all the change and the receipt back in the drawer and said, here's a fan. They slapped an IWW sticker on the fan. Not a single person got in trouble for it. 2 days later, the sticker proved too embarrassing for the employers, and so they got a nice industrial fan instead. Throughout this process, they were faced with illegal monitorings. It is illegal for employers to spy on their employees, and yet every store in the Mall of America was quickly bugged with very visible mics. There are illegal firings, and thus far we have overturned every single organizer-related firing that we faced with requirements for back pay. So all the work that they would have been paid for in the meantime has been required to be paid back. We've gotten a few free vacations out of this. Jimmy John's, our most recent well-known public campaign, again, focusing on the largely unorganizable, right? Jimmy John's is young workers. Jimmy John's is run on you may have seen rock stars, right? Or sub so fast you'll freak. Well, the slogan we came up with was wages so low you'll freak. Although wages are always a key issue, wages were not our primary issue in the Jimmy John's campaign. Instead, the issues were health code violations. We were tired of being forced to serve spoiled meat to customers. Sick days. We were tired of being forced to work with the flu. Scheduling. People were being scheduled closes and opens on a regular basis, so working until 11:30 or 1 o'clock in the morning, depending on the location, and then opening at 5:30. Right? And if you couldn't make that, which it's a good way to fire somebody, right? You schedule them for that, and then if they can't make it, they're late or they can't come in, you fire them. Right? And especially respect and dignity on the job, we had a lot of sexual harassment. Sexual harassment is ubiquitous throughout lower paid wage work in the United States. Again, we went to an LRB contract vote. I was the branch secretary treasurer for these years, and I'm embarrassed to say that I wrote my name on those contract application papers knowing it was a bad idea, but it wasn't my decision to make. It was the workers who engaged in that organizing struggle to make. Again, the officers of our union have no decision-making power. Everything is done by votes by those concerned. Okay? So we went for the contract and we lost by 2 votes, 85 to 87. Immediately after that, we filed 22 unfair labor practice charges, which after almost a year of review by the NLRB locally and then shoved back up to the national, which didn't want to touch it, which shoved it back down to the regional, was approved 21 of them. Including charges that the employers were buying votes for $40 a head, were shipping, buying all sorts of things for the workers. There were blatant intimidation, attempts at firings, lots of illegal stuff. I mean, I could go through all 21 if you like, but it was pretty horrendous. So the entire election was invalidated. There were penalties assessed. All of the workers have been mandated to receive their jobs back with full back pay. And we have yet to decide whether they're going to go back or not. They may not want to go back. They still get the pay, the back pay that they lost. But, you know, at this point, they're all on to other jobs and organizing in other places. This was the thing that really pissed him off. This came up after the election. And I wish I had a better graphic. Your sandwich made by a healthy Jimmy John's worker. Your sandwich made by a sick Jimmy John's worker. Can't tell the difference? That's too bad. Because Jimmy John's workers don't get paid sick days. We can't even call in sick. We hope your immune system is ready because you're about to take the sandwich test. They really didn't like this. Unfortunately, they didn't have a whole lot of ground to object. We had already publicly and on the news prevented Jimmy John's at several locations from serving spoiled meat. Right? They were really pushing and threatening to fire workers for refusing to sell meat that had been in an unrefrigerated, the power had cut to the refrigerator. And it was spoiled and it just smelled awful, but they insisted that we sell it until a non-IWW member called us and said, "Help, I don't want to do this." And so we immediately ran down there with our video cameras and everything else. I went in and talked to the manager, who was very unhappy that we were there. But finally, we got a health inspector down there because of the pressure, and they closed the place for the day. They didn't fire all six of the people who were identified as the primary organizers at the time. We're always surprised that they focused solely on the guys. We think that was a PR move. There were more female organizers on the job than there were male organizers, but they only fired the guys. It might also be because these guys were all on bicycles. These are bicycle delivery guys, and so that might have been part of it as well. They put those posters up all over the city, and these guys all got fired as a result. As we found out, they say these vacations might just turn out to be paid. Well, indeed they were, right? All of these guys have been mandated to receive their jobs back. We don't know when that'll happen because they're currently under an additional appeal. They can drag this out forever, which is another reason to avoid contracts in difficult to organize industries. If you have to wait 3 years to get justice in a job that typically lasts a person 8 to 12 months, you're pretty much out of luck. We keep relearning that lesson. I want to move on to education now, which is where a lot of my time is spent. As an education worker, but also it's one of the things I can do in the IWW. As a professor at a relatively well-run college with a high percentage of tenure and tenure-track faculty, not a single one of whom seems to think they are working class, it's my own job is largely unorganizable. So I spend my time supporting the union in other ways. We have developed an organizer training called Organizer Training 101, or OT101, which has become sort of the gold standard for organizer training in the United States across unions. Beginning with about 5 years ago at the Labor Notes Conference, which involves progressive unionists from around the world, and the United States especially, the organizer training began to become in deep demand from progressive unions who typically refuse to train their own workers. Right? So for most unions, organizer training is given only to staffed and salaried organizers, paid organizers. They don't actually train workers. They tell workers what to do according to their training strategies and tactics. We are working on a bottom-up model instead of a top-down one. Nevertheless, the training is so effective that SEIU and a number of other organizations have started asking for our training. It's been a bit of a debate internally as to whether we want to give them that or not. We keep getting raided by once we start up a shop, they come in and say, "Hey, you guys want a real union?" Okay. We also do an advanced trainer and training for trainers, so people who go around the country now and offer these trainings. Our organization model is, again, egalitarian and horizontal. If you go through Organizer Training 101, then please go on to Organizer Training 102, and by the time you're done with Organizer Training 102, you should be teaching Organizer Training 101, and right up the line. We also have something called the General Defense Committee, which is a parallel but subordinate organization to the IWW, which is dedicated to non-sectarian defense of the working class. Anybody who finds themselves in trouble with the law as a result of working class organization, it is the job of the General Defense Committee to defend. Lately in the Twin Cities, we've been focusing not only on fired workers, but also on the well-known case of Krishan C.C. McDonald, who is a transgender woman who was attacked by a couple of local neo-Nazis outside of a bar. She got glassed, cut through her cheek, and then she defended herself with a pair of sewing scissors that were in her purse. The guy was pushed onto the scissors. It doesn't really matter to me whether she stabbed him on purpose or not, but apparently he was pushed onto her. And he died. He died. Self-defense homicides happen in the Twin Cities with regular frequency. This is the first time Mike Freeman, the prosecuting attorney, has attempted to prosecute in a very long time. So this was clearly it's easy to pick on trans people. It's very easy to pick on trans people. And beyond that, we do the Work People's College, which I would like to show you a video of now. This just happened. Oops. The Work People's College just happened for the Work People's College, I should mention, was originally a Finnish theological and labor studies college up in Minneapolis. It was founded by Finnish immigrants. Finns are in America at least, tend to be incredibly radical folks. At least they used to be. And they, all throughout Minnesota, especially in the north on the Iron Range, they were at the forefront of labor struggle. The Finns didn't have a whole lot of social services serving them in Minnesota at the time, dominated by Germans and other Scandinavians like the Swedes and the Norwegians, with whom they shared very little in common. The Finns created their own institutions, a theological training seminary, along with a place that offered skills like reading and writing, English lessons. When you take shorthand, right? Okay, shorthand. All these skills that would help them find jobs, and keep their own lives together. This was the origin of the Work People's College. In 1921, it became the IWW Work People College and was refounded in Duluth, entirely done by Finnish folks, and was run there until, I believe, 1941, at which point it closed down. In 2006, the Twin Cities IWW refounded the Work People's College and began offering classes at local libraries and other public spaces. This year, we gained enough steam that we were able to offer a one-week intensive residential employment educational camp called the Work People's College Institute at Misaba Camp Co-op, which was founded by Finnish communists in 1929 and is still run as a co-op camp outside of Hibbing, Minnesota. And I will just let you watch this short 4.5-minute clip, which is about that. I was very proud of this.
IWW Work People's College is a 5-day intensive training program that offers workshops for IWW organizers to take their skills to the next level, learning the kinds of things that will help them build strong branches, create strong branches, and win campaign successes. We're also able to enjoy meeting fellow workers from all across the United States and Canada in the most beautiful campgrounds you could imagine, swimming in the lake while we're learning about organizing strategies. We're able to have critical discussions with each other, and at the end of the night, sit down by the fire and sing some songs, creating lifelong friendships that will support us from year to year.
Two nights in a row, we had rounds of singing down in the main building over there. It's really fantastic. I think Eugene Debs described solidarity as a really visceral sensation that you have. It's in your gut, you know, that to do that as a group also is very... It's encouraging, it's hopeful, it's powerful.
I came with the Work People's College as a part of this experiment of reviving this amazing institution idea of where workers are actually teaching each other these lessons and skills of how to fight back on the job, as opposed to experts or union staffers.
Just having this really intense kind of workshop atmosphere with a bunch of fellow workers just seemed like a kind of life-changing experience that I wanted to be a part of. Workshops I've gone to so far have been directly applicable to work I'm doing within the branch. It's all stuff that I can take back with me that I know is going to be useful to other folks.
No matter what workshop it was, it didn't matter the subject or how long I had experience with it. Ultimately, I was still learning a great deal, and I was just really proud of everyone. Everyone really brought it when it came to the workshops.
I think that the Wobblies absolutely should be organizing together and should be having sharing organizational experiences, and this really provides the tools to get that.
Junior Wobblies is a family camp that allows youth from infancy all the way up to probably about 12, 13 years old to come with their parents and have some independent time where they're able to explore the woods and explore concepts about capitalism and organizing. They get to enjoy crafts and the outdoors, theater and music. Work People's College is also a great opportunity to create the world that we would like to live in. In this space, we've been able to do things like transform the restrooms, for example, from men's and women's restrooms to single occupancy, all gender restrooms, so that no one feels like they're invisible here. And we've been able to just do this spontaneously through discussions and actually start to transform this site to reflect our values, our identities, and our community.
I've had fellow workers that are women, fellow workers that are trans women, a fellow worker with a disability. All of these people have said to me in the past couple of days that this is the longest period in their lives where not once were they mistreated by anyone or made to feel small or pushed around or objectified or spoken to as if they were infants. It just brings a lot of us to tears thinking about it.
My favorite part has been seeing all different people from different places and not only sharing our stories, but also talking about, you know, what it means to be a Wobbly and what are some people's different abilities and skills and how we can really sort of sharpen those.
I just have to say, the Union family as a whole is just amazing. I haven't met anyone that's been mean or anything. I mean, everybody steps up to help me. I mean, it's just, I just feel so accepted here more than I have anywhere else.
You can't miss it. The clinic out here, the nature out here, the people you're hanging out with all week while learning all sorts of fascinating stuff, there's nothing like it.
I am having a lot of fun. This has actually been one of the greatest experiences of my life recently.
I just feel like we're onto something, and I just think this is a really excellent step forward.
Capitalist beware.
I will end with a note that I was looking on the news yesterday. I have on my Google News, I have an IWW alert. And we have our fair share of celebrity members, I guess. The most recent celebrity member we got was a guy named Tom Morello, who I'm not seeing the age group here. They're a little younger than I am, but Rage Against the Machine was a band that was rather popular for a while, and he was their guitarist. Apparently, the new VP candidate for Mr. Romney, what's his name? Paul Ryan, has said that Rage Against the Machine is his favorite band. That pissed Tom Morello off, and he released a statement that said, "Well, Mr. Ryan clearly has a lot of rage. He has rage against immigrants. He has rage against women. He has rage against people of color. He has rage against working people. In fact, the only people he doesn't seem to be rageful towards are the capitalists who before whom he grovels for campaign contributions." Yeah. And so Tom Morello would like you to at least be aware that these tensions exist in the United States. All right. So with that, I've tried to leave as much time as possible, which is, goodness, as usual, less time than I would like, for any questions or discussion. Thank you very much.
So what's the status of IWW in Washington State? My hometown is Everett, Washington. We've
sure.
had a dark history with the IWW.
Yeah, well, you know that, don't you? So the great story...
You might be glad to hear it's taught in high school.
Is it?
The Washington State
The Everett
history
Massacre
classes.
Is amazing.
Yeah.
So the
yeah.
great... Everybody know that? Can I tell this story real
yeah.
quick? All right. Huge labor action. IWWs from all over the country came in. They came in on a boat. Do you know this part?
Well, yes. Yeah.
Please.
But... I mean, at least part of the tension that was promoted against them was the governor of Idaho had been assassinated, and
mm-hmm.
But I actually don't know if there was anything to that. Was I mean?
I don't know anything about
yeah.
that, and I we had renounced violence
sure. okay.
for a
yeah.
long time before
yeah.
that. Anarchists do deserve their bomb throwing stereotype, as long as we're talking about anarchists between the periods of 1870 to 1907. At that point, they got over the idea that the attentat, or the propaganda by the deed, would ever accomplish anything. It was clearly a reactionary and bad tactic. So it's possible that somebody tried to take up the governor of Idaho and thought that that would be a good thing. They probably weren't operating as IWWs at that point.
Sure.
But the part that I like about the Everett story is that they came in on a boat, all these people, and they were met at the pier by a bunch of vigilante sheriffs, you know, people who'd been deputized all of a sudden with guns and rifles. "Where's your leaders?" they said. And as one group, they all said, "Well, we're all leaders." So they threw them all in jail. They threw them all in jail, and the jail wasn't big enough, but it was a brand new steel jail that had been built. And they get in there, and the IWW starts singing, as they're prone to do, and start jumping up until finally the jail actually cracks. They were so stuffed in there. Now, how much of that is reality and how much of that is Union myth, I have yet to know. But it's a great story. Yeah, Everett has its own great and tragic history, as many of these places do. Seattle has a very vibrant IWW branch. I don't know if Spokane has any presence at all, but Seattle does, I'm sure. And Portland is the largest branch in the world.
My son works for Jimmy John's in Seattle, so I'm sure he would be very...
Let him know.
Yeah, okay.
Let him know. All he has to do is get in touch, and he'll be spoken to by very friendly folks who want to get him hooked up. Yes, sir.
Sure. short of, you know, organizing that kind of thing, how do you teach people that even if they're never going to be in a union, that it's good to have unions around because it lifts, you know, lifts everybody's wages, it lifts everybody's status as a worker?
What's your name, sir?
Dennis.
Dennis, I wish I knew.
Do you cover this in college? Or?
No, so we do talk about sort of reaching out to people and letting people know, but because of our approach, we tend to focus on workers who are already agitated. And we don't typically try, and we don't use the U word right away. In the United States right now, the U word is almost as bad as communism, right? I've been surprised at various points during my week here as a teacher with some of the hostility I've met when talking union in my sessions, even from very progressive Holdenites with whom I share so much. But the U word in the United States is a bad word, and we tend not to use it. Instead, we talk about how do we attack the particular problems. The issue you're talking about is getting that broader support that we so desperately need if we're going to have the people to defend working class organization. And I don't know. I don't know. I do know, I can tell you exactly how to destroy the appeal of unions in the United States, because that's a lesson that's historical. I don't know how to increase the appeal of unions to the United States populace without appealing simply to the one historical example I have, which is increasing working class organization. The more organization we have, the better it looks. And so these, we have to start small, we have to start incredibly, excruciatingly small, and we have to build. We have to build right. We can't build on bad foundations. So it's hard. I wish I had an answer for you that was better than that. Yes, sir.
It sounds like the IWW is opposed to capitalism.
It is.
Okay, then what is the alternative economic system that they do support?
That's great. So the IWW has opposed anyone trying to call it. So there's all sorts of people who want to claim the IWW for one political faction or another. The communists like to claim it because they think of it as the purest idea of worker organization. The anarchists like to claim it as an anarcho-syndicalist union, much in the vein of some of the Spanish unions. The Democrats have tried to claim it at various points when they were far, far, far more progressive than they are today. We have avoided allying ourselves with any of those political tendencies and instead call ourselves revolutionary unionism. We are absolutely and unambiguously opposed to capitalism. One of the slogans we prefer is that capitalism cannot be reformed. But what we propose is that workers take over their workplaces of employment and run their workplaces for themselves. This is a concept called council communism sometimes, or worker organization, or rank and file organization. The idea is that the people who do the work should be the people making the decisions. This sometimes seems deeply utopian to people, and so it's oftentimes very useful to point out the ways and the places in which it is historically and currently operating. After the 2000 collapse of the economy in Argentina, the most famous factory, there were a number of high-end suit-making manufacturers who closed their shops, and the workers said, well, you're closing our jobs, and we need these, and there's a demand for these suits. There just isn't enough demand for you to make your profits for you to want to keep this factory open. We can continue to work, and we will just cut your profits off the top. We don't need those, right? And we will continue to sell things. So they occupied the factories, and they ran the place. Now, those suit factories ended up getting repossessed by their former owners once they've been made incredibly productive and profitable again by the workers. The one that's still running that I know of is the Zanon Ceramics factory. Which was occupied and defended against both police and thugs hired by the former employer, who kept trying to take it back once it was made even more profitable. But this is a place where workers make all the decisions about how to produce, what to produce, when to produce, the schedules by which they operate, and they do it by direct democratic vote.
So I'm assuming that this would have a tremendous effect on the stock market.
The stock market would disappear.
Yeah.
Yep. Good riddance as far as I'm concerned, but yeah. The stock market would be a non-starter. Absolutely. Yes, sir.
I was very similar question. It just sounds like the IWW has tactics for operating within the economic system of capitalism.
Absolutely. And I'm so glad you put it that way. The preamble, I wish I could read the whole preamble to you. It's a little long for one person to sort of monologue at you. But the end of the thing is this: by organizing industrially, we are building the new world in the shell of the old. And so our idea is that without violent revolution, without an attempt to violently or militarily seize the state or political authority, we are trying to organize our world and our lives in such a way that we can continue to control our lives, that we can grow more and more autonomy over our workplaces, our lives, and our communities. We don't need to do this from within some sort of apocalyptic momentary struggle like some sort of 1917 Soviet revolution. Instead, this is a process that can grow at the moment in any place we work. And by the time we get large enough, we can run the show ourselves as workers.
So it would be an organic transformation?
Organic, full of struggle, full of struggle. Every single unionization struggle is a struggle, and people get hurt. On one picket line in 2007, I was attacked by a scab who ran his delivery van through me. Broke my neck in three places, and it took me a year and year to recover from the surgery and another year of PT to be able to walk around. So people get hurt in these struggles. So it's not that there aren't struggles. But it's that these struggles are not apocalyptic and momentary, right? There's no moment where you can say the Russian Revolution happened in 1917. That's not what we're looking at. We're looking at a progressive change throughout the workplaces. Yes, sir?
Are there a lot of examples of workers taking over companies in the United States and becoming worker owned?
There are a few.
Car manufacturing? I'm not sure.
I don't know of any. I don't know of any worker-owned places. There are co-ops. Co-ops tend to operate on a very different model, usually a shareholder model, and that's one of the difficulties with co-ops and why they have declined so roughly since the late 70s. Is that so many of the co-ops that began with sort of hippies deciding that they were going to run the stores that they wanted ceased being consumer co-ops where the people who were working there were the people who were also the shareholders. Instead, more and more shares began to be controlled by single individuals and they shifted to a consumer managerial model. And so many of the co-ops, the ones that have survived, have turned more or less into pretty standard grocery stores.
I think there are.
I would be fascinated to hear about it.
I think there are some companies where the workers took over because they were being closed, but that was in the United States.
I'd be fascinated to hear about it.
Wasn't Saturn?
Maybe.
Saturn was a split off from Ford, and they had very progressive labor sort of organization, but it was not a worker-owned subsidiary.
Do you distinguish between small businesses and the type of businesses who have the workers, the kind of number of the workers you're talking about? Yeah. How do you handle a small business who, you know, you've got one owner that starts the business, he's totally responsible for everything. Mm-hmm. You would say organize those two?
Anywhere workers want to organize, we organize. It's oftentimes very easy to imagine that smaller businesses are friendlier. And oftentimes they are until you start organizing. My own experience helping people organize in small owner-operated businesses has been that some of those employers are the nastiest in the fight. Not all of them by any means. People are people, and there's a lot of individual differences between people. But when we tried to organize at an individually owned coffee house in Minneapolis, the immediate response was a lockout and wholesale firing, which we haven't encountered in even any of the large franchises.
I understand your position against capitalism, but then I ask, so you've got businesses and union, or the workers are going to take over and make the product, and I agree with all of that. But then how do we in our country or the world continue to have new businesses where you need this venture capitalism to scale up?
It's a wonderful question.
Start making the better product with economics and scale, etc.
Absolutely, it's a wonderful question. It gets right to the heart of many of the definitions of capitalism. So Marx's understanding of the beginning of the capitalist era was that you needed initial startup capital. in order to create the means of production, factories, etc., on which workers would work. Now, he had an idea about where that original money came from, which was basically wholesale theft. But you do need original capital in order to start up new enterprises, buy machinery, find places to go. In a place where capitalism is not, and private property, remember, private property does not refer to your toothbrush, it refers to your factory, right? Your toothbrush is your possession, not your property. Property is stuff that makes money. So the way it would work is different according to many people. We try not to organize the future because we're democratic. We would like people to organize that themselves. There are different ideas about how that would work. Some people imagine that workplace organization would be paralleled by community-based organizations. There would be community councils. Other people argue that there should be consumer councils. All of these places might be able to have stores of capital, volunteer capital, and people who wanted to work on startup industries, which would be necessary, would be able to start up an industry in that way. One of the nice things, many IWWs were often known as Wadleys, hark back romantically to Barcelona from 36 to 39, when the unions, the Cenetistas, the CNT and the UGT, the UGT were socialists and the Cenetistas were anarchists. They ran the city after Republican Spain was attacked by the fascist Franco. And they ran the city on a completely open model. Everyone was given free food. Barbers were working for free. Shoeshine boys were working for free and refusing tips. Everyone was doing everything for free. Nobody went hungry, and yet things continued to be produced and things continued to be made. The original place that started was the telephone exchange in Barcelona, which began to run much more efficiently as soon as the workers took it over. So startup industries are perfectly possible. That's not to say that there aren't challenges, but there are challenges for capitalist businesses now in starting up a new business, a new venture. Finding the money is always tough. Yes,
sir. It's not just the money capital, but it's also the ideas, the concepts, energy. I mean, you're out of the computer there.
Yep.
You know, without Steve Jobs, there was no market.
I don't think Steve Jobs was nearly as important as the people making the boards. He didn't design any of those boards himself.
Well, without his idea, his concept, and his drive.
Yep.
To create that product.
Yep.
Now you could argue, you know, do we really need the Apple computer? Do we really need our iPads and stuff? Separate argument. But there's a personal capital, energy, ideas, things too, that somehow we've got to be able to keep that in the process.
I like to go back to the Zanon ceramic factory example in Argentina, where they completely revamped the factory. So basically they started a brand new factory in the property of the old. And the changes that they made included wholesale changes to machinery, which allowed for increased worker safety and comfort, quieter areas, especially in the heavy areas, and where those decisions were made. So this was innovation that was taking place at a level that was completely democratic and worker-controlled. There was no idea man up in the office saying, hey, let's do this. I've got a really good idea because I've got a college degree. Instead, it was a bunch of guys with third degree, fourth degree educations who said, you know what would work better? After they created these new physical structures, not just ideas, but they actually put them into place, the factory started running at roughly 25% better productivity. And that's when the previous owner decided, you know, I'd really like my factory back. So innovation is possible.
They're familiar with the process. They live every day.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so it's that skill, the skill that comes from daily experience, right, that really leads to innovation. Steve Jobs didn't come up with innovation in computers because he went to wherever he went, Stanford or whatever. He came up with it because he spent hours and hours and hours messing with circuit boards. And, you know, these are the sorts of things that let Steve Jobs come up with his innovation. I'm sure Stanford helped, but people are smart. We have infinite capacity at all levels of human society. The restriction of that capacity and that creativity is one of the great tragedies about the way we organize our system. We could be so much more creative if we weren't simply serving the narrow interests of, frankly, less than 1% of the country. Wonderful. Well, we've gone over time again. Yes, ma'am?
Oh, I just was wondering what you thought of the Mondragon
cooperatives. The Mondragon. Oh, the Mondragon is a heck of a story, right? Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I've never been there. I should have worn my Winnipeg IWW shirt today. The Winnipeg IWW has been very heavily involved in the Mondragon. The Mondragon is the place that everybody goes, right? in Winnipeg. I don't know that story, but it is apparently well, well respected within the Winnipeg IWW.
Uh-huh. Well, my understanding is that it's an area where, I mean, there's 7 Spring or 7.
Oh.
Well,
so there's a cafe and restaurant in Winnipeg called the Mondragon, which is what I was thinking of. It is worker-owned and operated.
Oh, okay.
Yes,
okay.
You're referring to something else.
Yeah, it's a whole area where several of the equivalent of counties have gotten together and they're all one big co-op.
Yeah.
Or several big co-ops.
So this is Southern Spain in the agricultural areas?
No, they're industrial. They make products.
Okay. Well, I've learned something, and I'm going to write that down so I can go
and
look
I
it up.
I thought it was called Mondragon. Something like that.
Might not be Aragon? Aragon? It's a different part of Spain. Okay, I'll check it out.
Is there something like that called Aragon?
There is.
Oh. Yeah. Then maybe.
I'll check it out. Thank you so much.
Okay, yeah.
Well, it is time for dinner. Thank you so much for coming. I've really appreciated the opportunity to talk to you.